my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk, episode 495. To be broadcast on Wednesday, August 26th on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. If you are watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment below. I may or may not be able to get back to you. Bicycle Talk is a show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle culture, bicycle advocacy, upcoming news in cycling, the bicycle business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show and you're listening on Facebook Live right now, you can comment right down here below, or you can send me an email at bicycletalk, the numeral one, at gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ron's Rant of the Week. Why is it that when I want to hear a really positive news broadcast on something really positive things happening in the U.S. due to cycling, I have to hear it on the BBC at 5 in the morning? For real? What is wrong with the American media and bicycles? Anyway, that's my rant. That's part of my rant anyway. And I'll touch base on this a little bit more in the rest of the show. Bicycle news. Another thing, I'm just putting it in on my rant just because we got a little bit of sad news here. Bicycle and Velo News legend, on a sad note, in Cornwall, Vermont, Tim Blumenthal, a journalist and cycling nonprofit leader, master storyteller, and nicest man in the world, quote unquote, died on March 30th at 70 after a 2-year battle with cancer. So I'll have a little bit more information on that. I was a longtime follower of Tim Blumenthal because he had been involved in lots and lots of bicycle media over the years, including Velo News, where he first started out, I do believe. And anyway, interesting guy. A lot of people really liked him, and unfortunately he's passed, but he left a great legacy behind. More in the show. On a positive side, bike lanes. So I got this thing about bike lanes, which I will mention in the show. There's a bunch of interesting information out there, and it's can AI help plan better bike networks? AI and bike lanes? Really? For real? Yeah. Well, that is that. Also, other things, bicycle lanes have a calming effect on traffic. New study. How come all these new studies are really not that new to us? But that's okay. This is what it is. And so we will get deeper into this in a moment. And let's see, what else do I have under good news? Kansas City. So I mentioned this earlier. I said something about how the American media doesn't pay attention, but the British broadcast system does. Or the BBC had Richard Hollingham and his producer Will Grant arrive on their bikes in Kansas City, Missouri in 2008. It had just been named the worst city for cyclists in the country. The resulting radio show came from a wake-up call that has since inspired new cycling groups and millions of dollars in investment in cycling and walking initiatives. So, big shout-out to Kansas City. We'll talk a little more in the show. Seattle shattered a record for bike and scooter trips across the Fremont Bridge in July, a sign that the pandemic dip is over. Yeah. And then I did mention AI for bicycles, but we'll get there. The other positive thing, it's Vuelta time. It's Vuelta time, baby. Here we are. We are in the midst of the Tour of Spain. It is amazing that we have gotten through the whole season already, and now we're into our final Grand Tour, the Tour of Spain. And it is Vuelta time, and it's about to become, I think, the Tadej Pogačar show once again. So we'll see. Okay. So Mechanical Minute and Bike Tips. This is going to go under Bike Tips. I got a lot of bike tips. I run out of mechanical things to talk about sometimes, but I've always got lots of extra little tips. And as I was listening to a broadcast this morning on public radio, I heard all about the fine art of sprinting. Yes, sprinting. Yeah, sprinting, something you would do, obviously, on your feet, maybe, you know, doing a very, very fast sprint from, let's say, the front door of your house to your mailbox if you live in a rural situation, or to blast yourself from, like I did last week, the town hall door to my car because it was pouring rain out. Sprints, a little sprint like that. So anyway, I decided that today is a day we're going to talk about sprinting and all the benefits that you can get from it, which I thought was just kind of a cool thing. So anyway, we're going to go here right now, and we're going to talk about 3 minutes of sprinting does something 90 minutes of exercise does not. Now, you hear me talk about high intensity interval training all the time on this show. I talk about it because I teach it a lot when I am teaching my indoor cycling classes. So it's, to me, it is very beneficial because you can pack in an awful lot of work in a very short period of time. And now they're now saying, this was as of August 21st, 2026, so very recently, just a few days back, a few minutes of sprinting may reshape the bloodstream far more dramatically with a much longer moderate workout. 6 30-second sprints altered nearly a quarter of the blood proteins measured and more than 200 metabolites, after where all 90 minutes of moderate cycling produced far smaller immediate changes. Many of the proteins affected by sprinting were also associated with lower risks of obesity, type 2 diabetes, and other metabolic diseases. So it's not rocket science, folks. It's science. Yeah, here we go. Just 3 minutes of sprinting may produce a molecular response that looks very different from what happens after 90 minutes of moderate exercise. So here's my tip to you as a cyclist. This is, I'll get back to that. Researchers from Rockefeller University compared how body responds to exercise performed at different intensities. They found that 6 30-second all-out sprints changed nearly one quarter of the proteins measured in the blood immediately after exercise. So how much should you sprint and how should you do this? The sprint workout also altered more than 200 metabolites and rapidly increased levels of proteins involved in blood vessel growth, tissue modeling, and hormonal signaling. Pretty cool stuff. Moderate exercise produces a slower response rate. And now the links to, of course, metabolic health and biological aging shows that researchers that compared the proteins that responded to exercise with health information for more than 53,000 patients. So this was in the UK Biobank. Many of those proteins were associated with lower risks of cardiovascular and metabolic disease. So what does this mean? I'm out riding my bike. Okay. And I am going to, maybe I'm just commuting on my bike and I've got generally I'm riding at a moderate rate. I'm not going to be killing myself while I'm doing it, but I take a look and I see, you know, maybe a mailbox up the road, and I put it in as whatever gear I can handle, and I get out of the saddle, and I jam on it hard, and I just sprint to that mailbox. If I can do this 6 times during my commute, I will greatly increase my health and fitness. How about that? It's not that hard, right? You could fit that in. Even if you're just going out for an easy ride one day, just throw in a half a dozen sprints, 30-second sprints, just throw them in there. And, you know, it's not real difficult. And in 30 seconds, you'll be a little winded, but then you'll have plenty of time to catch your breath. You don't have to put them on top of one another. You can break them out throughout your entire ride if you want. And you're going to get so much more benefit from this. So a few minutes of intense exercise can trigger a significant molecular response. And we still see it after 8 weeks of training, which tells us this response isn't simply a product of the body struggling to keep up with unfamiliar stress. It may also be that the responses we observe are intrinsic to intense exercise. Why exercise intensity may matter? The findings suggest that the exercise intensity may strongly influence the proteins and metabolites of released into the bloodstream, and in turn, the way tissues throughout the body respond. So just bursts, short bursts of vigorous exercise. That's all you're really looking for. So this is real interesting. I heard it on, like I said, I heard it on a radio broadcast, and then I went and I Googled it, and sure enough, I've found all sorts of interesting information on this. And just minutes of doing this can supercharge your health. So I do believe that I'm going to try to work this out into the next my next commute on my bike or my next bike ride that I go on. I'm just going to throw in half a dozen sprints, that's all. You know, my friend Dave Geisert, shout out to Dave, he's a big sprinter and always has been a big sprinter. He's, you know, a criterium racer. He's won a lot of races because he's got a very powerful sprint. It doesn't hurt that his legs are about the size of my waist, but that's one that's one leg versus my waist. By the way, he's a big guy and he can really put it out there. And you take a look at people like him, you take a look at people like Matthew Vanderpoel, and they've just got these big tree trunk legs and this amazing ability to pull up lots of wattage and in short bursts. And whenever I would ride with him, he was always sprinting for a mailbox. You know, he'd do it here, do it there, but we never really put it together what it was actually doing. Now it looks like the science is telling us exactly what's going on here. So this is a really cool thing, and I had to bring it up, and that is my tip of the week. This comes from a website called Science Daily. You can look it up, sciencedaily.com, and look up 3 minutes of sprinting does something 90 minutes of exercise does not. Very, very interesting information. So pretty cool. Anyway, we're going to move on to the show, and we're going to get into our content. So this press release, I mean, this just really drives me nuts. The U.S. media has such an amazing ability to grab onto really positive information about infrastructure and cycling and walking and all the good things that it does. And I get to hear this on a BBC broadcast at 5 a.m. on my local NPR station. What's with that? Anyway, it is what it is. 18 years after a harrowing report on cycling in Kansas City, two BBC reporters came back to discover a changed city. So they went there in 2008, and they were reporting on their experience in biking in America's worst city for cyclists. Worst city for cyclists. And their news story calls the changing landscape a revolution. So there is an audio on this. It's a podcast. It goes for about 30 minutes, I believe. It is on the Bicycle Talk Facebook page. So if you're interested in hearing it, then you should definitely check that out. I'll see if I can link it over to my YouTube channel also, but we'll just have to see if that'll happen or not. I'm not sure about audio files. Anyway, 18 years ago, the reporters warned to get their affairs in order before bicycling in Kansas City, because there were only 6 miles of bike lanes spread across the entire Kansas City metro. This time, the reporters found miles of new protected bike lanes, ambitious programs like Vision Zero, energized ride groups, passionate volunteers and advocates, and happy teenagers riding bikes together after school. And there's still work to be done. Bike Walk KC Executive Director Eric Rogers asks, why do Kansas citizens want, what do Kansas citizens want 18 years from now? Zero deaths from traffic crashes, a robust regional transit system? If these are the things we want, then our community leaders must have the courage to prioritize transportation for the people, not just cars. Gee, they're singing my song here, aren't they? Isn't that amazing? So, Bike Walk KC, by the way, was founded in 2010 by bicyclists who answered the wake-up call of the 2008 BBC story. It is Kansas region's first dedicated organization for bicycle and pedestrian education and advocacy. Their mission is to redefine the streets as places for people. We want a transportation system that prioritizes moving people, not just cars. So anyway, you can go to bikewalkkc.org and you'll learn a little bit more about what they're doing out there. I just really think this is amazing. It just really, when you listen to the podcast, I think you will be very, very impressed by what was discovered. I tried to get something in text from the podcast. I couldn't get anything in text. Somehow it didn't get translated over. So you just have to listen to it. That's all I can tell you. And it's very inspiring. And to go from one of the worst cities in the United States to ride a bicycle, one of the most dangerous cities in the United States to ride a bicycle, to being one of the best ones out there is truly a remarkable move. So shout out to Kansas City. Shout out to anybody else who's out there that is doing good things, like Seattle. And I had mentioned them earlier, and they're shattering a record for bike and scooter trips across the Fremont Bridge. This is all really, really, really good stuff. So anyway, that's a little piece on Kansas City. This one I just found to be really strange and interesting all at the same time. We hear a lot about AI these days. Everybody's talking about AI, AI this, AI that. What's AI going to do for us? Well, can AI help plan better bike networks? Santa Barbara County in California is about to find out. If it works, this could change the way bike mapping and planning happens in California. I thought this was kind of a cool story to tell, and so I am passing it on to you. In 2024, the Santa Barbara Council of Governments won a grant from Caltrans to use artificial intelligence to design a countrywide bike map collaboration with UC Santa Barbara and Simon Fraser University. By the way, if you've never been to UC Santa Barbara, what a great place to go to school. It sits on the ocean. I swear to God, it sits on the ocean, up high on a cliff, looking over the Pacific Ocean. It's gorgeous. Why wouldn't anyone want to go to college there? Anyway, I'm sure because they don't offer the programs you're looking for. Okay. The grant promised to teach AI to map bicycle infrastructure and develop a universal regional wayfinding plan and would revolutionize bicycle infrastructure mapping, that's quote unquote, according to a statement. Now the revolution will be put to a test. This week, the Santa Barbara County Association of Governments launched the map in English and Spanish and is seeking feedback from bicyclists to test the map's accuracy. The map is only as good as the information behind it. Transportation planner Peter Williamson said in announcing the project, the people who know our streets and neighborhoods best are the people who live, work, and ride here. The interactive map uses artificial intelligence trained on Google Street View imagery and OpenStreetMap data to estimate how comfortable people will feel bicycling on roads through Santa Barbara County. Riders are being asked to review the map and report missing bike lanes, incorrect route information, inaccurate comfort ratings, and other areas before public comment period ends on August 14th. So this was just a short while ago. it sounds to me, I don't know if you've ever used this app, but there's an app that came out a few years ago called Waze, W-A-Z-E. And Waze was designed for automobiles, was designed for motorized vehicles, but it also had a lot of input on it. So if you saw something that was a problem with the journey that you were going on, if there was a road hazard, if there were other things that needed to be noted, that, you know, this tells me to go right, not left, and it's supposed to be the other way around, whatever, then you could input this back in, and that would make the app better. And I think it was a collaboration between them and Google Maps, because they did use Google Maps on this. So this looks like it's one that's going to be designed for bicycling and Google Maps. This is brilliant. I think it's a great idea. So unlike traditional bicycle maps that simply show where bike facilities exist, the AI model attempts to classify streets based on rider comfort by analyzing roadway characteristics, including bike infrastructure, traffic volumes, speed limits, lane widths, and other features visible in the street imagery and mapping data. For transportation planners, that could make the tool useful for identifying where riders are likely to feel comfortable or where they're likely to avoid riding altogether, but only if the model matches reality. As transportation agencies increasingly experiment with artificial intelligence, Santa Barbara's project may become an early test of where AI can genuinely improve bicycle planning and where it still needs human judgment. So the project is expected to wrap up, including publishing its final maps in the summer of 2027. Hey, what a great idea. I think it's cool. That's why I thought I would talk about it today. So AI with your bicycle, what do you think? It's I think it's an interesting concept. Why not use it as a tool? You know, I think of the early days of an app I use all the time now called Ride with GPS. And I will tell you, it was very clunky at first because he would often tell me to go left when I really wanted to go right, or it would tell me that a street did not exist when I knew it definitely existed, and you had to kind of work with it and, you know, stop your ride and then do kind of a change, a straight line view through maybe a short dirt road section that Google Map never saw, because they were also working with Google Map. But it was definitely something that had to be worked with if you were going to be using it on a regular basis. So what I found was that I had to double check every single route that I posted on Ride with GPS, because sometimes they weren't right. And so you would have to make an edit in there to make sure that it was going correctly. And I think between myself and others that started using that app on a regular basis, we probably made enough corrections on it that Google then went on to eventually make corrections on it, because Google can only see so much. I don't know if you've ever seen a Google car, but they drive around and they've got a weird thing on the roof of the car, and they're basically taking photos, photo images, video images. I'm not sure exactly how they do it, but they're doing that as they drive down the road. I know if I go to Google Map and I put my address in, it not only shows my house down the driveway, but it also shows a car that I used to own a few years ago, because they don't update all the time very rapidly, but it still, you know, it gives you an accurate representation of what there is on the road as you're driving down the road. So it's, you know, this is a good thing, and I'm sure that if they can start using it as an urban planning tool that other cities can use across the country, this will be a really, really cool bonus for AI. As much as I am like a little concerned about AI and maybe a little bit sick of hearing about AI, this gives me hope. It definitely gives me hope. So let's talk about bicycle lanes. Bicycle lanes have a calming effect on traffic, so says this study. Geez, Boy, I could have told them this a long time ago. Anyway, a new study found that bicycle lanes, especially those with physical or visual barriers, can have a calming effect on traffic. We kind of know this. This is not new news here. So if you put a barrier down where a motorized vehicle's tire is going to hit it and it's going to make them bounce back into their own lane where they belong, put down that cell phone, please, then obviously it has a way of calming traffic and maybe slowing it down a little bit, like, I'm going too fast. Maybe I shouldn't have done that. You know, that sort of thing. So according to the data collected by the Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention, the CDC, crashes involving motor vehicles are the leading cause of death in the United States among individuals younger than 55 years of age. The Federal Highway Administration reported in 2022 that bicycle lanes could reduce crashes on local roads between 30 and 49%. Given these statistics, a study published on Science Direct investigated the impact of temporary bicycle lane on enhancing safety. The study, called Traffic Calming Effect of Delineated Bicycle Lanes, conducted by Hannah Youngs and her colleagues, delved into how bicycle lanes, especially those with physical barriers, influence motor vehicle speeds at intersections. Using computer vision technologies and techniques to analyze the speed and trajectory of over 9,000 cars at a signalized intersection in Asbury Park, New Jersey, the research aimed to quantify the impact of temporary bike lanes on traffic flow and safety. So, bicycle lanes reduce vehicle speeds. Very simple. The findings indicate that significant reduction in vehicle speeds in the presence of marked bicycle lanes suggests that these lanes benefit cyclists and enhance overall road safety by calming traffic. The research highlights potential of temporary or pop-up bike lanes as a low-cost, flexible solution for improving cyclist safety and encouraging active travel. These lanes gained popularity during the COVID-19 pandemic to facilitate outdoor activity while maintaining social distancing. Remember COVID? Yeah, interesting, isn't it? The researchers implemented a temporary bike lane using orange cones, traffic delineators, and temporary chalk paint to separate cyclists from motor traffic. The setup allowed for comparative analysis of vehicle speeds before and after the lane's implementation. The results showed a 28% reduction in the average maximum speeds and a 21% decrease in average speeds for vehicles turning right when the delineated bike lane was present. Vehicles traveling straight experienced an 8% speed reduction. Interestingly, painted-only bike lanes also led to a modest speed reduction, but exclusively for right-turning vehicles. These findings highlight the additional benefits of bicycle lanes in urban traffic systems. By calming traffic, bicycle lanes protect cyclists and reduce the risk of the severity of crashes for all road users, including pedestrians. So this isn't like any real big new news, but it's very, very interesting, I find. So, hey, this is funny. 7 myths about car-free cities debunked. Yeah, why should cities be car-free? The UN predicts by 2050, more than 2/3 of us will live in cities. So it's in our interest to make them as livable as possible. Reducing the number of cars on the road has immediate long-lasting effects on air quality. But it's not only just a health benefit. As people look to other forms of sustainable transportation, active transport will rise, resulting in more cycling, walking, and running. This translates to happier, healthier populations. Sounds like my kind of place, right? And do we mention the noise? Noise pollution is almost as bad as air pollution when it comes to our health. The problems range from mild irritation to insomnia, to heart disease or premature death. Wow. So I was perusing through YouTube and I saw this comparison video, and I probably should have bookmarked it and placed it onto the Facebook page, but you could probably find it yourself if you were looking to see. And it was a video of a very busy street in a very busy city, not sure exactly which one it was, and the noise, just the noise that happens when you have cars out there and cars on the road, the tires making noise, the engines making noise, the horns beeping making noise, the general noise that comes from cars. And then they had transformed that street over into a bicycling and pedestrian friendly street. And when they transformed it over, they took the exact same video at the exact same time of the day. And what did you hear? Silence. Nothing. It was quiet. It was peaceful. It was very, very, very nice. And this is why we need more bicycles on the streets. And as I quote a friend of mine who talked to me about this years and years ago, a classic sales guy who was in the bicycle industry, put more butts on bikes. It's the solution to all of our problems, more butts on bikes. And I will never forget that because it's quite true. So, yeah, car-free cities. We should probably do our best to try to do that. So your myth number one, car-free cities are bad for business. Well, I guess we've talked about that. It is really not. Some business owners are concerned that fewer cars are going to mean fewer customers. Sure, that might be the case in an all-out of-town shopping center, but it isn't in an urban environment. Studies consistently show that footfall increases when a street is pedestrianized, resulting in a rise in retail sales in some trial areas. Even better, the era of online shopping, pedestrian area can bring some life back to the high street. So according to Euronews, research also shows that even when parking spaces are taken away, people don't throw a tantrum and abandon the trip, but instead look for alternative ways to get where they need to go. The bottom line, when people need to go to the shops, they will find a way, even if it isn't by a car. What a refreshing idea. Myth number two, people won't visit car-free cities. On another frequent fib is that stops cars from entering, then people won't visit. On the contrary, car-free cities are not only more accessible, but also a tourist attraction. The Greek island of Hydra is one example where the lack of cars makes its destination a hotspot for all of those who are seeking some peace and quiet. I talked about quiet earlier. Looking for an example of a bigger city? How about Ghent? Introducing car-free zone into the center has completely transformed the city. The overall attractiveness of Ghent as a major shopping and tourism destination. Looking at pictures of it before and after, you'll be hard-pressed to disagree. That might be where I saw that. So look that up. That's G-H-E-N-T. And you will see the difference that happened there. Myth number three, car-free cities discriminate. Oh. If a city wants to improve mobility, then limiting cars is a legitimate concern for the elderly or people with disabilities or impairments. Good, thoughtful design is crucial to planning a car-free city, as well as a well-designed one meets the needs of all its residents. Public transport must be as accessible as possible, both practical and financial, to those who need it. This means that everything from ramps on buses, trams, and trains, or to subsidies on free travel for those who need it. Far from being ableist or ageist, we well-designed car-free cities address accessibility issues, especially for those who are most affected. Number four, myth. Car-free only works in small towns. Car-free initiatives are often disregarded as utopian and difficult to implement on any meaningful scale. Critics will say They're only good for small towns. If that's the case, somebody should tell Copenhagen, Amsterdam, Osio, whose largely car-free centers prove that with proper planning, education, and infrastructure, car-free cities are indeed very possible and functional. Of course, there are many factors to consider. Sometimes it can be as straightforward as adapting existing infrastructure, but how Helsinki has converted a disused rail line into a cycle superhighway. In others, it can require a drastic overhaul. When with size comes difficulty, but that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be worth working towards. After all, Rome wasn't built in a day. And then our fifth myth on the list here, it's too late to go car free. There will always be cynics that say it's too late for people to change. The fact is that driving continues to be a norm because cities facilitate it. Margaret Thatcher famously said that a man who beyond the age of 26 finds himself on a bus can count himself a failure. Oh, Margaret, get over yourself. As Wired points out, it's kind of a stigma which is preventing people from opening their minds to the alternatives to driving. Research shows that when cities take action to reduce the limit of the number of cars, they rarely go back. Everyone can benefit from city streets and fewer vehicles, even if they can't all imagine it. This is why congestion pricing works. This is truly the answer. When they implement things like this, it just changes the way people think. And they do think about it. They do think about getting tagged with a $6 fine for driving into a big city. And they do think about where am I going to park my car because there's no more places to park my car. Even though there are more parking spaces in the United States than there are cars in the United States. Which is a hard thing for me to believe, but I did some research and that's what I came up with. So, number six. I said there were six myths. I thought there were five. Anyway, car-free cities are expensive. One of the most frustrating myths is that a car-free city is expensive. While the infrastructure indeed costs money, it will save or even make money in the future. According to WorldCrunch, a study in Copenhagen showed that for every kilometer of bike lanes built in the city, 400,000 euro were generated in benefits through reduced transport, healthcare, and accident costs. Compare this with the significant cost of maintaining road infrastructure, traffic management systems for cars, it's clear that car-free cities have some financial benefits. Oh, look, I got this wrong. Number seven. How many were there here? I thought there were only five or six. I must have. No, there's seven. Okay, number seven, because we're not done yet. Myth, car-free cities are anti-car. Well, maybe so. And last but not least, we have those saying that car-free cities are anti-car. Well, they're not entirely wrong. See, I did say that. Car-free cities are designed to make cities better places to live for everyone. Whilst cars are generally discouraged, they are usually not completely banned. Those who need to use cars, such as people with mobility issues and emergency service vehicles, can still do that. In fact, with fewer vehicles on the road, they can do it better than ever before. The main theory is that people don't need to drive as much as they do. Estimated that at least half of car journeys worldwide are under 5 kilometers, a distance that for most people could easily be covered with bicycle or public transportation. Cars in cities continue to create problems for residents, businesses, governments, and visitors, but reducing the number of vehicles with a car-free city model is one urban planning strategy that could have some answers. So there you have it, the seven myths of why car-free cities are bad. They're not. They're actually exactly the opposite. So I thought that was kind of cool. And now we're going to move on to a few other things in the show. And one is going to be a quick shout out to Tim Blumenthal and his family and the loss of Tim. For anybody who was around back in the 60s and 70s, yeah, I'm one of those people. There's lots of stories about Tim. Blumenthal was part of a print journalist. He was a print journalist for Velo News back when Velo News was just print. Yes, a kind of a newspaper-type tabloid, magazine newspaper-type tabloid. And it covered bicycle racing, which was kind of cool because I was a bicycle racer. So he started as a journalist for Velo News back in the 80s. Television commentator covering the Olympics and Tour de France for NBC in the 90s, served as the International Mountain Bike Association's first executive director in 1992, and then moved back to the leadership role of At People for Bikes, then Bikes Belong, in 2004. So he passed away at the age of 70 after a two-year battle with cancer, and there were some great quotes from speakers to the 100 people at the memorial that might give you some insight to his unprecedented and heartfelt contributions to the bicycle advocacy movement in America. Liz Blumenthal, Tim's wife of 46 years. Stories were a tool for Tim, a modus operandi. As a parent, as a boss, as a writer, a reporter, as a friend, he used stories to paint pictures of athletes, to build the excitement in race coverage, to teach lessons to our children and to our employees, not telling them how to behave or what to think, but by leaving them with a story to contemplate. John Burke from Trek Bicycles. John Burke is the president of Trek Bicycles. I gotta believe Tim packed in at least 100 years into the 70 he was given. Tim was a good leader. He was a great leader. He had high humility and he had incredible will. Always the cause before himself, but never about Tim. It was always got the deal done, and after the deal was done, people on both sides still felt good. He brought the industry together, he brought the advocacy groups together, he even brought politicians together, and he moved the meter. There's so many comments here from so many people, and it's people like Jen Dice, People for Bikes president and CEO, Connie Carpenter Finney and Davis Finney. Folks from way back in my day, Olympic and Tour de France cyclists. I'll mention this one. Our relationship with Tim goes way back to when he was a journalist. We rarely faced journalists with Tim's qualities. He was prepared, he was fair, he was truthful, he was kind, and Tim was, of course, also brilliantly effortless writer. Above all else, he was genuine. What a great quality to possess. So anyway, lots of people said lots of kind words about Tim Blumenthal, and I just remember reading lots of articles in, I think he also contributed to Bicycling Magazine, I do believe, because that eventually maybe got swallowed Velo News got swallowed by Bicycling and the whole Rodale thing. Not 100% sure on that. You can check my facts on that one. But it's definitely a cool thing. Hey, Chris, how you doing? Hey, Bill, how you doing? Yeah, look at this. And Rick, too. I've got a few people watching today. Very nice. Maybe this is the better time of the day for me to be doing this. So anyway, that's my little piece on Tim Blumenthal. And now I think we just have got to move on to the thing that is happening right now, the Vuelta in Spain, the Tour of France. If you are watching, spoiler alert, if you don't want to hear about Monday's race was, so I would turn your speakers off now or whatever you want to do. But Monday's race was classic. Well, we've heard about the snow and ice in the Giro. We've heard about the heat in the Tour de France. So why not? Hail forces riders to seek shelter and cancel La Vuelta Stage 3. Yeah, for real. Hail. So UAE team Emirates XRG was at the head of the peloton between climbs. Whilst it was impossible to see riders at the back of the peloton seeking shelter from the hail that had begun falling on them. Tadej Pogačar was one of the riders then gesturing to bring the race to a halt. With 15 kilometers to go, the riders in the peloton headed towards a large building at the side of the road. So they were actually 15K to the finish, and they were near Andorra. So that's where it all happened, and it's... Yeah, you just never know what you're going to get with the weather as far as the riders go. So that happened today as I am doing this taping of this broadcast. So if you get a chance and you want to see what it looked like, it was coming down marble-sized hail, and at the end of the storm, it actually looked like there was at least an inch and a half or 2 inches of hailstones on the road. Not something you want to ride your bike through. So anyway, I've seen different things, postponed stages of Grand Tours. I have experienced some hail myself. When I rode my bicycle across the country back when I was 20 years of age, we went over Trail Ridge Road at Rocky Mountain National Park. If anyone has gone over Trail Ridge Road at any time in their life, you can shout out to me. It's over 12,000 feet of climbing till you get to the peak, and it is really pretty spectacular. A lot of your time is spent above treeline, so you're out in the wide open. Well, there we were above treeline, told that we should get ourselves over the top before 1 p.m. because there were often pop-up thunderstorms. And of course, you know, we've seen thunderstorms before. We've been caught in weather before. Shoot, we were really close to being caught in the middle of a tornado once on our cross-country trip. How bad could it be? Bad, let me tell you, real bad. So the lightning strikes were everywhere. Every high point rock that was at the top of that mountain climb was being struck by fingers of lightning all around us. It was insane. And yes, we shouldn't have been there. And no, we did not get hurt. Although I will tell you that right after the thunderstorm came through and the lightning bolts were coming down, it turned into hail, like driving hard hail. We knew we had another quarter mile or so to go to get down the other side of the mountain to what we were told was a ranger station that existed there. We were hoping, really, really hoping that ranger station really did exist. We could barely see where we were going. The hail was coming down so hard I had welts all over my arms and all over my legs from the impact of the hail coming down. And then up in this distance, I see a building off on the right-hand side. And I shouted out to my friend Brad and said, "There it is. It's right up there. Let's go." We rode up to it, literally slammed our bikes down against the side of the building, and then ran inside with the ranger standing there and going, "Did anyone ask you guys about the weather report or tell you anything about the weather report for today?" And I said, "Yeah, we were told to get here by 1 o'clock, but we didn't make it." And he said, "Well, I'm glad you're okay." And people were just coming up to us and going, "I can't believe you were out there on that. That was crazy." And it was crazy. So I know what it's like to ride in hail. I don't know if you do or you've ever had an experience like that, but I've ridden in hail. I've ridden in thunderstorms. I've been close to some pretty big rumbling storms, including the night before my son Greg was born. I kind of got a bit of an earful of of complaints about that. So anyway, we were out on a Friday night ride. You know, it was like Friday night ride. We always go on the Friday night ride. Yeah, they were threatening thunderstorms. No big deal. We're going to get back before that happens, right? Positive thoughts. Yeah, we didn't. So what happened is the bunch of us were up in, we were in Lebanon, Connecticut in a very high point up there. And the thunderstorm started rolling through, and then it was every man for himself. And we basically split in whatever direction home was and headed for home. And I got real wet, and I definitely had some rumbles that practically knocked me off my bike, but I got home. I made it. the things you do when you're young and foolish. Oh, well, I did. It's done. It's over. So the Vuelta. Let's talk a little bit more about the Vuelta, because we're just three stages in right now, and we got a long ways to go before we get ourselves done with this race. It is the last of the big three of the Grand Classic multi-stage races that are out there. And it was the first stage started with a time trial, 9.4 kilometers. Geez, you barely have time to get on your bike seat before you're off it again. 9 kilometers, that's not very long. So seeing as 5K is 3 miles, I'll let you do the math on the rest. It's not very far. So anyway, stage two was from Monaco to Montesquieu, and that was 201 kilometers. Today's stage was well, the postponed stage with 15 kilometers to go was 174 kilometers and had some pretty serious climbs in it. So it was an interesting stage by far. And then tomorrow on Tuesday will be 104.8, and that is promising to be a pretty hilly looking stage also. So we're going to be starting out with a long, long climb, and then it will get, it will basically, it's a category one climb, and then it's going to roll down, down, down. It's going to go over a short second category one climb, go down again, a third category one climb, and then rolling down towards the finish where there's a little bump of a category three and then a finish. So short stage, not super long, but that will be tomorrow's stage. And then we will be looking at, come on now, I need this all here. The stage five is on Thursday, and that one appears to be a little bit more gentle, although it's pretty rolly looking. Again, very, very rolly. They certainly know how to throw in climbs. Yeah, we got a category one at the very end, very steep, looks fairly long, and there's also, it starts with a two, a three, and another two. So rolling as it goes, big climb towards the end with a long descent to the finish, and that will be Thursday's race and ride. So yeah, and then Friday we're looking at stage seven, and again it looks to be once again a long climb to the finish. It's vertical meters, 3,597 meters, so distance is 149.8 kilometers, and that should be a very, very interesting race for stage seven as we go into the weekend. Stage eight is stage eight. And then Sunday is stage nine, and then we'll have a rest day going. And stage nine looks like a roller coaster until a mountain finish on a Cat 1 climb. So lots of little short poppers, lots of little places for breakaways to get away on Sunday's race, and we will see how it goes. So it's all coming up. This will be the first full week of the Vuelta a España. And we should see some excitement, I'm sure. Tadej Pogačar is favored to win this race, and I don't have a lot of doubt in that one right now, because he is really looking very, very fit these days. The competitors that are out there with him are, you know, Richard Carapaz is in this race. Wout van Aert is in this race. Wout van Aert looks very good right now, so we shall see. Jay Vine, Christophe Laporte. There's definitely Felix Gall also, and Tobias Johansson. There's Mads Pedersen. You know, there's some great riders in this race. So you never know. You never know. And as we say in bicycle racing, never depend on anything, because anything can happen. So we shall see. The individual time trial on the first stage was won by Mr. Tade Pogacar. So that's where it is. And Matthew Brennan won stage two. It's going to be interesting, I'm sure. It always is. And I just love watching bike racing. It's always very, very interesting. And we will see what it produces in the future. So anyway, that is what I have for today. And we are about to wrap up our show as we're getting close to the end. And make sure I have covered everything I wanted to cover today. And it looks like we are there. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions here that we will throw in here. And as we're looking at the events that happened this week, you know, the weather events, that's something that you definitely want to reflect on. If you want to send some information over on the worst weather, what is the worst weather you have ever ridden your bike in? Come on, we all have stories. Of course we do, because we ride. We ride our bikes. We get caught in things that we wish we had never put ourselves through. I remember getting caught in a snow squall once. Little did I know, you know, they had predicted a possibility of snow showers. And it was early season, and I was trying to get some base miles in. So I'm out riding my bike, and the snow squall dropped 2.5 inches in a matter of minutes, it seemed. It wasn't very long that I was out there dealing with it. It was more than exciting. So, you know, what's your experience? I'm sure you've been caught in some sort of weather. If you ride a bike, you're going to deal with weather. That's all there is to it. And of course, if you're commuting on your bike and you're using your bike as a machine, a tool of which to commute with, you can carry extra clothing with you because hopefully you would have a rack on the back of that bike and also the ability to fill it with, put panniers on it and have at least an emergency pannier that just has changes of clothes for when they're necessary, or maybe additional clothes for when they're necessary. How many bike rides have you gone out on where it started out as a perfectly beautiful and wonderful day, and then by the time you got home, you were shaking and freezing because the weather turned on you? It happens. So anybody, finishing points, any listeners out there as old as I am might remember Tim Blumenthal, great guy. Please feel free to share your stories. And while you're at it, give us your opinion. TikTok. Gas prices are up again. As long as we have conflict in the world, gasoline is not going to be the answer. Fossil fuels are just going to cost more and more money. So why are you paying all that extra money to the fossil fuel industry when you could be out riding your bicycle? Are you ready to park that car yet? When you decide that your freedom begins with the thing you discovered when you were a child, depending on your bicycle, your world will change. And remember, bicycling is freedom. Life is better for everyone when more people ride bikes. Cycling is an easier and safer option for more people because when more people bike, people are happier, healthier, our communities are safer and friendlier. Our planet is greener. Let's all work together and help more people know the joy of bicycling. I'm going to say it again. It won't be my last time. You have to get loud, get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic and dangerous roads, the price of gas, and the lack of places to safely ride, and do your part. Show up to your local town meeting. Make a proposal. Think about it. Put together some good problem-solving answers and make your presentation. And hey, take that Pedal and Ron challenge. Consider parking your car for a day and ride your bicycle instead. You may just surprise yourself. And remember, whether you're riding your bike or driving your car, please be safe and kind. And remember that every person you pass has someone waiting for them at home. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You've been listening to Bicycle Talk. If you're watching on Facebook Live, feel free to comment down below, or you can send me an email to bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. If you want to contribute information, drop me an email. This is Pedalin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down, the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It really could save your life. This is 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Get out!